Welcome to Ekhatra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekhatra AI.
So today we're diving deep into a really foundational piece of literature. I mean, a book that arguably kicked off the modern English novel as we know it, Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe.
It really is a cornerstone text. And Defoe himself, born around 1660, well, he wasn't your typical author figure, was he?
No, not at all. He was a merchant involved in politics, even a bit of a journalist and pamphleteer. He was definitely in the thick of things.
Absolutely. And all that real world experience, you can see it in his writing. That keen observation of social realities, as it's often put, it gives the novel its texture.
And that grounding is probably why he's seen as such a pioneer. So let's set the scene a bit. When was this published?
1719. And you have to remember what that means. Britain was massively expanding its colonial reach. Maritime trade was exploding. People were fascinated by stories from faraway places.
So there was a real appetite for this kind of narrative.
Exactly. Defoe took the true story of Alexander Selkirk, a Scottish sailor marooned for years, and he elevated it. It became more than just an adventure yarn.
Much more. It basically established the template for the realistic novel, the survival story, and something really key for literary study, the Bildungsroman.
That's it. The Bildungsroman, the story of a protagonist's growth, their moral and psychological development. Crusoe's journey is a huge meditation on, well, on human nature itself, on
right.
What happens in isolation.
And that's what we want to track today, isn't it? His journey from this impulsive young man to the figure he becomes on the island. And we need to unpack those underlying tensions, fate versus free will, that kind of thing.
That tension is there right from the start. His father gives him this very sensible advice. Aim for the middle station of life. Stability, comfort, you know.
The respectable bourgeois life.
Sensible.
Very sensible. But Crusoe, he's having none of it. He's got these rambling thoughts, as Defoe puts it. He's impulsive, maybe a bit ungrateful for what he has. That restlessness is what sets everything in motion. And his first attempts at adventure are, well, they don't go well, do they? It almost feels like a warning.
Definitely. His first trip, shipwreck near Yarmouth. The text itself calls it a divine warning. But he's stubborn.
Doesn't learn his lesson?
Not at all. Second voyage, he gets a taste of the slave trade. Third voyage, he's captured by Moorish pirates in Saleh and becomes enslaved himself. A complete reversal.
There's a kind of immediate consequence there.
Yeah.
He escapes, though, with the help of Shuri, showing some early resourcefulness.
Yes, he does. But then he lands in Brazil, sets up a sugar plantation, and actually starts doing quite well. He finds success. Prosperity.
He actually achieves that middle station his father wanted for him.
Exactly. It's almost like poetic justice in a way. He gets what he was supposed to want, but threw away. He could have stopped there.
But calling it just poetic justice might be simplifying it. I mean, he's participating in the economic system of the time, right?
Expanding his plantation involved the exploitation common then. Is Defoe purely condemning his greed, or is it a wider commentary on that era's ambition? I think it's probably both. Look, Crusoe makes a choice. He has stability, but he wants more. Specifically, he wants cheaper labor for his plantation, which leads him to join an illegal voyage to Africa to acquire slaves. That's the crucial, catastrophic decision.
Driven by greed.
Driven by greed, yes. And that's the voyage that ends in the famous shipwreck. His moral transgression directly leads to his physical isolation. The punishment fits the crime in Defoe's structure.
So the island isn't just random bad luck. It's a consequence, a place for him to confront himself. Mm. Tell us about his arrival there.
He washes ashore, the only survivor. And the island itself is presented with this inherent contradiction. It's lush, abundant, almost Edenic in its natural resources.
Not utterly isolating.
Hellishly isolating. His first response is pure survival instinct, but filtered through his merchant background. He's very methodical.
That practicality is key, isn't it?
It's everything. He makes trip after trip back to the wrecked ship, salvaging tools, gunpowder, wood, food, anything useful before it breaks apart. He builds a shelter, takes meticulous inventory. He starts to kind of impose order on the wilderness, recreate civilization from scratch.
And this process transforms him over the, 28 years he's there. The gentleman who couldn't settle down becomes this incredibly skilled survivor.
Skilled craftsman, farmer, builder, you name it. He learns through necessity. But the deeper transformation is spiritual, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. That happens during a severe illness, right? He hits rock bottom, feels completely abandoned.
Yes. Despair sets in. He thinks he's being punished by God. But then there's that small moment of grace.
The barley.
Some discarded grain he thought was useless suddenly sprouts near his shelter. And this tiny, unexpected sign of life makes him reconsider everything. It sparks this profound sense of divine providence.
He starts to see a pattern, a purpose, perhaps.
He does. He reflects, how mercifully can our great creator treat his creatures? He starts to find meaning, even gratitude, in his harsh existence. God isn't just punishing him. God is also providing.
But what's interesting is that even as he finds this spiritual dimension, his fundamental mindset doesn't entirely change. He's still very economic about things.
Oh, completely. His diary reads like ledger sometimes. He talks about profit and loss, even in moral terms. He approaches survival like a business venture, calculating, improving, maximizing his assets on the island. It's a fascinating look at early economic individualism.
He needs that structure, that sense of productive labor, maybe to keep from going mad. He's constantly working, improving his estate.
Right. It's work that gives him purpose. But then, after years of this solitary routine, everything changes again.
The footprint.
The single human footprint in the sand. After all that time alone, the terror shifts. It's no longer about nature. It's about other people, specifically cannibals who visit the island.
That discovery must have been profoundly disturbing. It shatters his controlled world.
Completely. And it leads, eventually, to the arrival of Friday.
Tell us about Friday. Crusoe rescues him from being eaten by other cannibals.
Yes. And Friday is presented as inherently good, loyal, quick to learn. But the relationship is complex from the get-go.
Because Crusoe immediately establishes dominance, right? He names him, teaches him English, insists on being called master. It's very much a colonial power dynamic, even as a friendship develops.
Absolutely. Crusoe feels compelled to impose his own cultural and religious framework onto Friday. That hierarchy is built in. He sees it as civilizing him.
But Friday isn't just a blank slate, is he? Defoe gives him moments where he questions Crusoe's beliefs.
Right. That's the really interesting part. Friday asks these simple, logical questions about Christianity, about God and evil, that Crusoe actually struggles to answer. They reveal certain, let's say, inconsistencies or difficulties in Crusoe's own worldview.
So the savage, in a way, holds up a mirror to the civilized man.
Precisely. Friday's arrival turns Crusoe's monologue into a dialogue, creates a small society, and forces Crusoe to articulate and perhaps re-examine his own assumptions. It's a crucial step in his humanization.
Okay, so now he has company. A small society starts to form. How does this lead towards the end of his time on the island?
Well, the island population grows. Some Spanish sailors are shipwrecked. Then Friday's own father arrives. But the real trigger for leaving is an English ship that shows up. The problem. The crew has mutinied.
Ah, so chaos arrives from the outside world.
Exactly. And Crusoe, using all the strategic thinking and, frankly, the authority he's developed over decades of ruling his little island kingdom, he steps in. He helps the captain suppress the mutiny.
He basically engineers the situation to regain control of the ship. It shows how much he's changed. He's a leader now.
He is. And that's his ticket home. He returns to Europe after nearly three decades away.
And what does he find? Is it a happy homecoming?
It's complicated. He finds out he's actually very wealthy. His investments in Brazil were managed well for him. So financially, he's secure. But his parents are dead. He feels out of place back in England. Defoe describes it as an incomplete integration. He tries to settle down, but that old restlessness seems to linger.
Interesting. So even after everything, he doesn't just slot back into that comfortable middle station. Why do you think Defoe leaves it somewhat unresolved?
Maybe because you can't go through something like that and remain unchanged. He's mastered an entire world on his own terms. Regular society, perhaps, feels confining or less meaningful after that. His later travels suggest he never fully settles.
Let's touch on the style again. What makes this incredible story feel so real?
It's Defoe's famous verisimilitude, that journalistic eye for detail. He describes everything, how to build a canoe, how to make pottery, how to fortify a shelter with such practical, believable specifics.
That factual grounding, even for fictional events, was revolutionary, wasn't it? It makes you buy into the premise.
Completely. It pulls you in. And connecting back to the big themes, you see that constant interplay between Crusoe's own actions, his individual agency, and moments that feel like providence. He works relentlessly, but key events like the barley growing or the ship arriving seem almost divinely timed.
So it's not just one or the other. wine will seems to work through his choices and their consequences.
That seems to be the implication. And you also get this deep exploration of civilization, the effort it takes to build it, the constant vigilance needed versus maybe the simpler state of nature, plus that core tension between needing solitude and needing society.
He finds satisfaction in his solitary work, but his joy when Friday arrives shows how fundamental human connection is.
Absolutely. I think the novel lasts because it digs into these fundamental questions. How resilient are we? What does it mean to be self-sufficient? How do we create meaning when faced with apparent meaninglessness? It forces you, the reader, to think about those things.
And perhaps what it really shows is that true self-mastery comes only when you're stripped of everything external, forced to rely entirely on yourself.
Yes, and that the act of building that meaning of imposing order and purpose onto chaos is perhaps the most deeply human endeavor there is.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.